to San Anselmo, to the Western Career Development Center, and all of us had to go there. And so we took a battery of about 6 tests and went through a day of interviewing. And a week later, I got a phone call saying that I had been selected. So I figured the other 3 must have been crazier than me, and I got the job. Since that time, I figured maybe they were the smart ones, because there are 300 congregations about in the South Pacific District of the American Lutheran Church, and the district covers 6 states: California, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, Hawaii, and a little chunk of Texas, El Paso. So I have to cover that territory, and I work with about 80 congregations that are impacted by changing communities. And that change, as you might suspect, is mainly racial, but it can also be lifestyle changes, like from single-family dwellings to multi-unit apartment buildings. Well, for instance, Santa Monica, California is 85% apartment residences. Or it can be economic changes, either poorer or richer. Some of the churches that were started some years ago in Orange County were not that wealthy, and all of a sudden Orange County is very wealthy. A church in Pacific Palisades wasn't really started as a church for affluent people, but Pacific Palisades is now one of the highest cost areas. So the change can be either way. The change can be age change, that the population just has gotten older, as all of the population is. The median age in the United States since 1970 has gone up from the median age of about 18 to the median age of 29. So the population's getting older. Whatever the change is, it affects the life of the congregation. And I thought I would, I brought along a couple of maps that show pretty significantly how this change affects an area like Los Angeles. I work primarily in the Los Angeles area, in the Bay Area, Oakland and San Francisco, in Phoenix, Tucson, San Diego, and I've been to Hawaii once. So those are mainly the areas. I also work in the rural areas of like the San Joaquin Valley, that rich agricultural valley that runs the center of California. But this map shows the, I'll take it down because you probably, can you see it back there?
Yeah.
Okay. Under the hood. Okay, this is the Los Angeles area. And the main reason I brought the Los Angeles maps is because they're the best ones that I have. A lot of communities don't bother figuring out all of this stuff, you know, but Los Angeles has to, and especially as it was redistricting for busing. This is the way Los Angeles looked racially, ethnically, in 1950. And in 1950, as you know, the Lutheran Church, all of the Lutheran churches, I'm not only talking about the ALC, decided that the West was a great mission field, because in the 1950s, after World War II, we had this vast immigration of Lutherans from the Midwest. Long Beach, California is mainly Iowa. You know, it's all people from Iowa. And from the Dakotas out especially to the upper Pacific Northwest. And so the churches, Lutheran Church, decided they had to allocate a lot of their mission funds to start churches in the West. This was the way Los Angeles looked in 1950. Now the pink areas are, you know, this crazy color coding. Pink are the Anglo or Caucasian counties. So you see how pink the whole thing is. And then you have this little tan area that is the Hispanic population, and up here, and a little bit out here. And then this sort of dark gray or light black area, which is the black population. And these areas, the gray, are statistically non-significant because they're like airports. It's Los Angeles International Airport, Long Beach, and Van Nuys Airport. And then you have the white areas, which are racially transitional in 1950, and this little tiny yellow dot up here is Chinatown. So that's the Los Angeles area in 1950. And we planted all of these churches In 1950, the American Lutheran Church in the South Pacific District had, in the early 50s, about 45 churches. And now we have 300. And most of these, the bulk of them, were planted. Jumped from 45 to about 220 churches in 1950. So that's what it looked like then. Now, if you keep that in mind, and you look at this map, which shows the census. These are all based on census tracts. The way the census tracts are now, these are predominantly. Notice the change. You suddenly see how, even though they've included more pink area, you see this wasn't on the last map, this part. So it looks like. So if you take this off, so it's more like the last map, you can see how the Hispanic area has just zoomed out and taken over all of East Los Angeles, up here in the San Fernando Valley, Sylmar, San Fernando, and is moving down here. And if you were to follow this line, which is Highway Number 5, Golden State, runs all the way up to San Francisco, and then joins with 450 to run down to San Diego. If you would follow Highway Number 5, you would see it extending all the way down to San Diego. That's predominantly, in many areas, except in San Clemente and a few places like that, Hispanic. Notice how the black population has significantly spread. And you see, especially amazing, is the spread of the yellow mark. Before, there was just that tiny little Chinatown dot. And now notice how many of the areas are predominantly Asian. So it's on the basis of that kind of change that our congregations have had to deal with newness in mission. And I have all kinds of statistics with that bear that out. Some of you have, this was the Los Angeles Times, Anglo enrollment in LA schools expected to skid, Anglo or Caucasians in California, because there are so many Hispanics. The opposite of Hispanic is Anglo. That's Caucasian. In LA schools expected to skid to 14% by 1987. 14% of the children in the LA school district will be Anglo. Now remember that most of our congregations started in the 1950s were in the Los Angeles and San Diego areas. And some of you saw the national magazine articles. Newsweek had one, Time Magazine. You see this, you know, about 3 months ago or something. Chicanos on the move. And mainly in the Southwest. So that in the southern districts of the American Lutheran Church, Texas, through the South Pacific District, the six states I talked about, live 70% of the Hispanic people in this country. And we have toward a new ethnic majority in Southern California. And as minority groups increase in number and economic clout, guess who's responding to that? California business, of course. So what happens? While the church has remained through the years rather unaware and unconcerned about the changing community, companies like Anheuser-Busch, you know, is really, really set out to grab off the Mexican-American market in beer, because if there's any word that all of us who are Anglo know in Spanish, it's cerveza, which is beer, and California is the biggest beer market in the country. With apologies to all you Milwaukeeans and Wisconsin. And strangely enough, Milwaukee is one of the largest wine markets in the country. But Anheuser-Busch went after the Mexican-American market, a territory which had belonged to Coors, with a Spanish language advertising and community involvement programs, so that in a few years, Budweiser became the number one brand in the Spanish-speaking market for the first time in 20 years. Well, there are a lot of people out after the Hispanic market, but the church has really, until just the last few years, not been concerned at all about the growing number of Hispanics. But one of the, as I mentioned, one of the most remarkable changes has been in the Asian Americans, so that now one-third of the immigrants to our country are Asian, people from the Asia area. One-third of all the immigrants. Now you think of that, and think of what a change that is making in our country. And most of them land on the West Coast, and most of them, except for the Chinese, stay there. The Chinese pretty much headed east. That was a different population trend. So what's happened? In 1950, you had immigrants coming mainly from the Midwest and from Europe. Because you remember, right after the war, Lutheran World Action was involved in that, bringing people over from the countries in Europe that had been under Hitler and then under the Russian domination. So we had Lutherans, lots of Lutherans coming from Estonia, Lithuania, and all those countries that were Lutheran, from East Germany. So that in 1950, from Europe, we had 132,000 immigrants from Europe coming in a year. Now, there are less than 73,000 a year coming from Europe. But listen to the change in Asian immigrants. In 1950, only 15,000 came in a year. Now, 167,000 come in every year from Asia. In 1950, there were only 62,000 coming in from Latin America. Now there are 157,000 coming in every year from Latin America. So,
Mexico does it?
Yes. Well, Mexico, yes, definitely. And we don't even have any statistics on the number of undocumented workers who are coming. We don't call them illegal aliens, because we call them undocumented workers, simply because it's not a fair name. It's not an appellation that's really very fair. After all, we've had Canadians who have come in and worked in the United States for years and years and years and never were made to carry a green card, and never were naturalized as citizens, and worked here for 25 years and went back to Canada to live, and nobody complained about that. So we think that it's an unfair appellation. We don't call them illegal aliens, those of us who care about Hispanic people. But what what does this do then to the church? Well, I do a lot of charting of trends and showing people exactly what's happening to the church out there. And so I do a chart like this. For instance, that shows. Now each column represents a different church in a different area. And if you look at their statistics, their five-year percentage of loss and gain in membership, income, expenses, average attendance, weekly pledge, whatever. You don't have to look at all the bottom, but here's the top. You notice in this one, a 15% loss in baptized membership, 31% loss in confirmed. Income went up 38%, but the expense went up 84% because of inflation. And the average attendance stayed pretty much the same. Now, isn't that fascinating? What does that say? What does that say to you? If in a lot of these churches, the attendance doesn't change that much, but the statistics do.
Clean their files.
Clean their files, or what it says is maybe in the 1950s, people were coming for reasons other than commitment to Christ. Mm-hmm. They were coming for prestige, for certain family reasons, for education of children, whatever it was. Maybe the faithful always were there, but the rolls were full of people who wanted their names for some reason on the church rolls. Maybe it was a value to have that kind of institutional connection in the 1950s. But we've gone through the 60s since that, and maybe the value of an institutional connection isn't all that great. But here's one that has gone down 66%, baptized, 60% confirmed, income 30% lost, the expenses have gone up 2%, or the income's gone down 30%. And you could go through this chart and look at it. So those are the congregations I work with. And I find it exciting. But then maybe that's my problem. Why do I find it exciting? because suddenly I find churches wrestling with some of the very important questions that a lot of the churches in the 50s never wrestled with. All you had to do in the 50s in many of these churches, and I know because we served a very large church in North Hollywood, California, which is still one of the largest churches in the South Pacific District. And all you had to do was open your doors and people flocked in. And we had adult instruction classes of 80 to 100 people all the time. And nobody wrestled with why is the church here. You knew why it was there, because Lutherans were moving in and they had to have some place to go to church and they had to have some place to educate their kids. And now the churches that I work with actually sit down and wrestle with what is our ministry in this area in which the church has been planted. And that's exciting. I wonder how many of you come from the Midwest. Okay. How many of you actually sit down and have planning meetings and retreats that just simply deal with what's our mission in this community from the Midwest?
Now?
Yeah.
Living in the Midwest now?
Yeah, living in the Midwest now. Okay, there's one over there. Okay, there are some. But all of the churches I work with have to ask that question. Simply because, and a lot of the churches elsewhere should be asking that question. But if you look at an institutional life, you know, the life of an institution has a life that's very much like the bell curve and the life cycle for all of us. We all start out at birth, we come to prime, and then we go into our declining years and then death. But organizations have that kind of life too. And so they start out here with a vision of, you know, this is a place where homes are coming in, people are coming in. We've got to plant the church there. The word of God must be spread. People must be taught. We must fulfill the command of Christ to go and make disciples of all nations. So that vision gets hold of people, and you find a lot of energy sweeping the church up. People like to belong to a new church, a new mission, and it goes up. And then comes a time of plateau. And that is usually 25 to 30 years in the life of any congregation, where it plateaus out. And that's where we are now. See, these churches that were started in the 50s, in the early 60s, they're at their 25th, 30th year, some 20. But during that time, all of a sudden, you plateau out. And everybody starts saying, what's happening to our church? How come people don't come anymore? How come we don't have those large classes? And what do you think the tendency is then?
Evangelism.
Well, evangelism? What kind of evangelism?
Just gathering more members.
All right, and doing it how?
Well, I've seen them try with bowling teams. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, the tendency is to look back and say, what did we do then? And so churches tend to become conservative. Now this is cyclical, you know, like we talked the other day about the lazy eight, that we go back and forth in movements. And so churches go through very conservative periods where they hold the line. And when you get to the place where you're plateauing out, you tend to be conservative and never to want to risk. No risk attitude. And you say, the problem is there's too many newfangled notions. You know, we got to go back and see what they did in 1950 that was so good. And usually it's, we had a really good pastor then. You know, he knew how to preach, he knew how to get the people in. If we could only get rid of this dud we've got now, you know, and get a pastor like Pastor Smith, we would really have something going again. And so it gets to be a tough situation and a tendency to look back. Besides, what's happening? The second generation is moving away. The kids of those pioneers are married, having children, and they're out looking for homes elsewhere. And their tendency is to move out into the suburbs and to leave the cities, especially when the cities are becoming other racial and they don't want their kids in school with other children of other races. And so they move away. The older folks are left in the area, and they keep saying, we've got to build up our Sunday school. But all the white kids are gone. And the only way they'll have a Sunday school again is if they reach out to the new ethnic group in the community. And of course, they're all eager to do that. It's at that point, usually, or somewhere down here, at some point, that I'm called in for intervention. You know, when they decide that they've got little to lose, and everybody has circled the wagons, and they're sitting around the campfire telling myths about the past, how great the past was, and how awful those hostile forces out there are, and they've circled the wagons, and it's survival. And it's at that point that I come into the congregation. But I accept energy wherever it is. And if survival is the energy that's there, I'll work with that. You know, that's one thing I think we have to learn in the church, is to take the energy where you find it and move with that energy. So the congregations that I work with that are impacted by change have a lot of history, of course, behind them that affects them now. And all of us in the Lutheran Church have to be aware of some things about our history that may mean that we will not survive in other ethnic areas. And mainly what we have to overcome, the biggest obstacle we have to overcome, is our ethnic heritage. When you think about it, the Lutheran Church is the only Protestant church that came to this country not speaking English. Did you ever think about that? Congregational church, English. Episcopalian, English. Presbyterians, English. Methodists, English. Baptists, yeah, Dutch Reformed, but the, they aren't as...
so small.
So, yeah, very small.
30,000.
Something like a quarter of a million members.
The old DNR church was from Germany.
Okay. All right. But pretty much the other large denominations, if you look at the large Protestant denominations, came over speaking English. Baptists are pretty much native to the United States. Now, that says something about us, that we were drawn together by a language barrier. We have an awful lot in common in our history with the Hispanic Americans today. And it amuses me to hear people object to the fact that in California we're insisting on bilingual education for Hispanic children and for Asian children now too.
Say that again?
We're insisting on some bilingual teachers.
We are.
Yeah, in California. The Californians are.
Is that good or bad?
Well, I don't know whether it's good or bad, but it's necessary. And yet we tend as a Lutheran church not to be very understanding of that. But the first congregations, now here I'm on the job 3 years ago, very green, not knowing what's happening, the only person in a position of this kind in the Lutheran church, so I had nobody to confer with. And my first assignment was to go to San Francisco and merge two congregations. And one congregation was 100 years old and one was 75 years old. And the 75-year-old one was a split off from the 100-year-old one. Because 75 years before, the 100-year-old congregation had refused to teach the children in English. It was a Norwegian-American church founded for the families of Norwegian seamen in the San Francisco port. And they refused to do it. So the kids and their children split off, and 2 miles away they started another Lutheran church. Both Norwegian Lutheran churches, but one English-speaking, one Norwegian-speaking. And there had been a lot of hostility, of course, for all these years. Well, 2 years before I came on the job, they had deteriorated so far in their beautiful big sanctuaries. And in each one of them, about 45 people, 30 maybe, worshiping. And so they finally had no money to afford a full-time pastor, either one. So they called a pastor and they yoked in ministry. But they even fought over who would get the 11 o'clock service. And they finally drew straws, I guess, and one had to have the early service, and then the pastor had to run over to the other for the 11 o'clock service. So that was the scene I came into. And, you know, that's where I learned one very important fact for all of us who work in the church and think that everything is up to us. And I learned that the Holy Spirit is alive and well, even when church people are racist, antagonistic, hostile, and just wanting to survive for their own ends. And that was the case. Both of these churches were concerned about their own survival. And, of course, neither of them wanted to give up their identity, but they saw the handwriting on the wall. The future was gone. The one church, the youngest church, was now in a totally Hispanic barrio. And across the street from it was the large St. Charles Church that really served the Hispanic community very, very well. And the other one was in an older community, a lot of singles, young adults in the area, across from a big park. It was full of single young people every Sunday afternoon, and none of them came to that church right across the street. So I worked with the one congregation, the older one first. Then I went over to the other congregation, and it looked pretty hopeless. Until at the end of the meeting, a woman, 76 years old, and I could see that she was very agitated. She hadn't spoken all evening, and there were about 35 people sitting around the table. The median age must have been about 70. And they called one boy, I'm doing it too, one man there, boy, and he was like 55, you know, so it was, but at the end of the meeting, this lady, 76 years old, I know how old she was because she told me afterwards, and she got up, and just very trembling, she said, while I've been sitting here, I have just become convinced that the Word of God is bigger than either one of our congregations, and that the kingdom of God is bigger than either one of our church buildings. And the important thing is that the Word of God continue to be preached in this area according to our Lutheran tradition of the grace of God. Now, could you say it any better? And here is an older woman, not theologically trained, but the Spirit put her under such conviction, and she changed the whole meeting. And it was this younger church that was especially resistant to merging because they felt a deep sense of guilt toward betraying their parents who had started, and their grandparents who had started the church. And so then we started working on it. Once you get past that resistance, you can work on it. And then we talked about what should be done, and I suggested that both of them dissolve their corporations, form a new corporation so that neither church would have its name predominant. And so now, in February, I was there to speak at the dedication of a new congregation, a merger of those two churches, called Golden Gate Lutheran Church. Instead of Ascension and Trinity, now it's Golden Gate Lutheran Church. And wonder of wonders, these churches have called a pastor with the name of Kreiselmeyer. Both Norwegian Lutheran churches. And that was a big step forward. In fact, when I was there for the dedication, one man with a heavy Norwegian accent said to me, you know, I didn't want to like him when he first came, but somehow he rubs off on you. And they've gotten together, and it's not going to be easy. They sold Trinity Church to the Presbyterian Koreans for $300,000. And now there's a Korean church there. And now it seems to me they face the greatest danger of all, and that is from being two churches struggling with what's our mission here. They hadn't struggled very hard. They were just struggling to survive. They are now one merged congregation with a lot of money in the bank. And that's maybe their greatest danger, because the temptation then will be to sit around and think you're going to survive because you have money in the bank and you don't have to reach out to the community. But I talked about our ethnic bondage, our language background, and our racism and classism, which we share in common with the whole human race. And that's a barrier that you always have to struggle to overcome. And there are a lot of ways that churches are dealing with this, and maybe some of them which sound so logical may be demonic. I don't know. I'm out there where we have the school of church growth, for instance. And how many of you are familiar with church growth principles? Dr. Schuller practices church growth principles. A lot of the growing churches out there practice church growth principles. Some of them are fine. Some of them simply, the principles, first of all, just asks, do you want to grow? Now, a lot of churches, well, most of them will say yes. There isn't a church when you first ask that question where the people won't say yes. Of course we want to grow. But when you press them farther, you find out they really don't want anybody else to come in because they like it the way it is. And if other people come in, it's got to be on the terms of the dominant group in that, you know, so it used to be that Swedes didn't want Norwegians in, or Norwegians didn't want Germans in. And now it's, of course, that whites don't want blacks in, or don't want Hispanics in, or don't want Asians in, or if they do come in, they have to become Norwegian or German or Swedish, no matter what their racial background. And so that really gets to be a problem. But in the whole church growth movement is also this. Number one, number two, you don't touch controversial issues. And that sounds good, doesn't it?
That you don't touch controversial issues.
Church growth principles. See, there's a school of church, there's a whole body of literature called church growth literature. And comes mainly out, it came out of England to begin with, and world missions. But it's about 20, 25 years old, but it's only since 1970 that it's come into the United States church scene. And you don't touch, so therefore, if you want to grow, for goodness sakes, don't get involved in social issues in the community. Don't ever take a stand as a church for fair housing, for the helping the poor. Don't take a stand against something like Proposition 13, which brought $3.2 million to the Bank of America and $2.8 million to Pacific Telephone, but didn't do a thing, of course, for the poor who don't own property. In fact, knocked out a lot of their programs. Don't ever take a stand against anything like that. So you never find Dr. Schuller, whose church grows, we all know that, ever taking a stand on the fact that Garden Grove is a very racist community. And in all of Garden Grove, 110,000 people, there are 169 blacks. You know, you don't take a stand, because then you appeal to those people who are racist and classist. And then another principle is you don't take in people of other racial groups, because they'll tell you in the church school of church growth that you've got to work on the homogeneous unit principle. And they say this makes good sociological and psychological sense. And the church growth principle, the homogeneous unit principle, is that you only work with segregated groups of people in congregations. You don't ever try to have a pluralistic ministry. You don't try to mix racial groups or ethnic groups. You avoid that if you want your church to grow. Or if you bring them in, you bring in people who have your value system. In other words, you can have blacks, but they've got to be blacks who are of your same class. They've got to be in a certain income bracket, certain educational bracket, and that's your ministry. So you fight that kind of thing all the time. And in that kind of situation, what do you do with a church that comes out of a majority church background. The Lutheran Church came over as a state church. We came over from countries where the Lutheran Church was it. It was a state church. What do you do in a situation where you're only 1 to 2% of the population? In the Southwest, the Lutheran Church is 1 to 2% of the population. In Minnesota, I think it's something like 17%. In the South Dakota, something like 25% of the population. What do you do where you're 1 to 2% of the population and maybe at the most 10% of the population has ever heard about the Lutheran Church? What do they know about it? And especially where a lot of them are Catholic. How do you act in that situation? So you find churches really being conservative and you find pastors being very, very conservative and not wanting to risk. So here are some of the things then that I think that we need to do if we're going to even survive as a Lutheran church in minority communities. I mean, not only minority people, but where we are a minority church and not a majority church. I see that we're going to have a renewed commitment to the community. And I like to think of that as where the church, when it wrestles with its mission in the community, thinks of itself incarnationally. Here are the parish boundaries, and here is the church. And instead of drawing its members from out here, who will drive in 10 miles, 20 miles, 5 miles to church, it starts conceiving of itself once more as the parish church. And it says we're planted here, and we're going to live and serve this community. Now, one of the congregations I work with has moved 4 times to escape black people. It's moved 4 times, physically relocated, sold out and relocated. And now it's up on a hill, and up the hill, it's 95% black. And there they sit, a little white island on the top of the hill, and the members are too old, too tired, and on fixed incomes to move again. And what they've done is wasted 25 years of ministry. Because now they have to start living incarnationally. There's no place else to go. And if we can get a renewed commitment to where we are, and like Jesus Christ say, you know, here I am. I identify with the people here. Their hurts become my hurts. Their needs become my needs. Their pains become my pains, and we minister there. I talked to a young pastor who's starting a new mission. One day, spent about 3.5 hours, we had lunch together, and he said to me, what evangelism programs do you have for me? And I said, the most effective one I can give you is that you start, now he's got a church sign, a sign up on a site saying proposed site or site of a proposed American Lutheran church on a piece of property in an area that has 1,000 homes around it. So I said, okay, here's your program. Today, you take your calling card and you walk the streets of that neighborhood and you knock on every door and you introduce yourself and you say, I am the new pastor of a new Lutheran church going into this area. You are in my parish boundaries and I'm here to serve you. If you have a church home, God bless you. But if you don't, I'm the pastor in your area. You call on me if you have a need. And I'm here to minister to you. And you don't go around just looking for Lutherans. And that's what he said to me. He said, we don't have many Lutherans here. And, if he did get Lutherans, he'd probably have 4 families, and that's where he'd stay. But you conceive of yourself as in ministry to and with all of the people in that area. And you claim your parish for Christ. And you participate in the life of that community. And if housing is a problem, you go after the housing. And if drugs are a problem, you go after it. Whatever, you identify with that community. And you penetrate the community. You participate, you penetrate, and you pray over it. Like Christ praying and weeping over Jerusalem. And that becomes, to me, a new style. We've gotten away from that. We draw members who drive from distances. When I go into a congregation, I ask the group, how many of you walk to church? How many of you here walk to church? How many of you live in small towns who walk to church? Okay. You see, but in the cities, people drive to church because they've abandoned the inner city, but they feel a loyalty to the old church, so they drive in. Some as many as 20 miles. Well, in rural areas, often they drive 20 miles too. That's not uncommon. But you get the idea that your parish is only those people who gather on Sunday, instead of the parish being everybody in the territory your church serves. Okay. Then I would have a new definition of success. And I hound the bishop and I hound people to, what do you really expect a congregation to be like if you're going to affirm it? Are you going to say they have to gain so many members? What about a congregation that is in a city, has 49 people worshiping on Sunday, probably will not really grow very much, but has in its building a day nursery for the children of poor people, mainly single parent mothers, for their children. They have a daily food program for the poor and lonely elderly in the area. They have a ministry to prisoners, to the family of prisoners out of that congregation. They have a Finnish language service on Sunday for the old Finnish people in the area. Is that church successful in its ministry? Of course. It has two worker priests, a woman and a man. Not married, they're not a couple. But both of them have to work at other jobs to support themselves, and they each get paid by the congregation $41,000 a year. $4,100 a year. I would bet they would. If they could. But $4,100 a year, they each get paid. So they have to earn the rest of their living themselves. Now, is that a successful congregation?
Yes, definitely.
Now, really, is it successful?
What is the population around it?
Oh, it's got a big population around. It's right
There's
in the middle of the city.
49 people attending.
Yeah.
Sunday service.
Yeah. But an awful lot come for other ministries.
Mm-hmm. Are these 49 people doing the ministry, or...?
Yeah.
They're working awful hard.
Yes, they are. And they're tired. And they're interracial. They have Asians, blacks, Anglos, Finns, Danes.
What you're saying is that these people that they're serving, and they're taking advantage of the 49 people, but they're not coming on Sundays.
Well, some of those people also are involved in the program in the community. They come in to help feed the poor, and it's the community that's doing prisoner family work, but they're doing it through and under the auspices of the church, with the church people involved. They also participate. It's partly a cooperative day nursery where they help with that.
Is there a sharing of the word?
Oh, yes. It's traditional word and sacrament ministry.
Okay. No, I mean, this is the one thing I would ask.
Yeah, traditional word and sacrament. Very liturgical.
Okay.
No, you see, I think what we have to do is come to some redefinitions of what is success, so that we stop affirming only the churches that are big and that have all kinds of people, but maybe what they're doing is just simply serving a traditional community and ignoring the needs of other people in the area. So I think we need a new understanding, and that understanding has to be affirmed by the district people supervisors and by the national.
Do you see any churches where, I guess my question is, can the Lutheran Church serve the Hispanic in such a way that the Hispanic can feel a place to come comfortably to worship? Can the Lutheran Church serve the black community to where they can come and feel that this is a place where they belong and they can worship?
Yeah.
Because what I hear is wonderful giving social service to the people that need it. I love it. I'm glad that's happening. But I would love to see that the Lutheran Church could also be a home for the black and the Hispanic. And I
okay.
talked about that. And
right. Let me say that an interesting thing you're doing right now is saying the Lutheran Church and they. We have black Lutherans. There are black Lutherans.
49-member church. Where is it located?
Right in the middle of San Francisco.
Okay, it's not the same one that you were talking about
no.
a while ago.
No, this is another
my
one.
My question, tying with the one that you were talking about
yeah.
a while ago, why didn't they get a Hispanic, possibly, a possibility, a Hispanic pastor there?
We don't have that many trained. We don't have that many Hispanic pastors trained. So we have to have new methods for recruiting, if possible. But that's a whole area that's very, very difficult. But there are black Lutherans. We have a black coalition of black Lutherans, black members in the American Lutheran Church. And there are Hispanic Lutherans. So yes, we can and we do reach them. And some of the most fascinating churches I've been in are those interracial ones in Inglewood, California, in the Los Angeles area. One of the most vibrant churches that I've been in is one that's 60% black and 40% Anglo. And, love and community and a sense of sharing.
I don't even know why I'm saying this because I can't jump to any conclusions, but we have a friend who's married to a German woman and he is serving in Berlin. And for a while, he's a pastor, and he was able as an American to go across the wall and come back, whereas a German could not, and he ministered to what had been parish. But now he's moved, and he's in what we would call a typical state church situation, right? He's in a big building and so forth. And he and people working with him do many social services. They have the same thing. They have the, and very few people in church.
Yeah.
And we, as American Lutherans, have we not traditionally criticized the state church for doing exactly that? Being in the social, they're paid virtually by the government, they do all these other things. And but it's an interesting thing to me now that
mm-hmm.
we who have criticized the
yeah.
Europeans for doing this,
and
that's what in a sense you're recommending.
I think it's both and. You never
yeah.
get away. You have the word and sacrament, you have the social, it's all one piece. And all you have to do is read Edna Hong's book, Bright Valley of Love, to understand social concerns in the light of the gospel. And you see the Betel community at Bielefeld in Germany. A Lutheran deaconess has started it to pick up the outcasts that Hitler was going to do away with. The people, 1,000 epileptic fits a day at Betel. And, all of the offscoring of society. There is a social ministry out of the Lutheran Church. Okay, I want to quickly make two more points. I think we need a new understanding of the importance of the ministry of the laity. I think if our church is going to survive in the future as in mission in this country, and don't think that the Midwest is going to be immune from pluralism. You can find some pockets, but you go to Minneapolis and you see the change. You go to Chicago, you go to any urban area, and we are 95% urban in our country now. 5% of the population actually live on farms. In Benjamin Franklin's day, it was just the reverse. But we are an urban society. So we have to reckon with the pluralism that's happening all over. But unless we as laity take charge, we have to, because we have been a state church, we tend to leave it up to the clergy to do the job. And I was traveling on a plane, PSA, from Los Angeles to San Francisco, to Oakland one day, and next to me in the, they're always crowded, these commuter planes that run the corridor between LA and the Bay Area. And I was working with some figures, congregational figures, and the man sitting next to me asked me what I was doing, and I told him, and he asked about my job, and I told him, and he said, "I've got the answer to all your problems." And I thought, "Well, great, tell me. What's the answer?" He said, "Fire the clergy." Fire the clergy. And of course, he turned out to be a Mormon lawyer. But he said, "I'm a full-time lawyer. I have a big caseload, but I'm the bishop in my..." What is it, stake or ward?
Stake.
What's the larger one?
Ward.
Oh, see, that's the confusion. I think, okay, stake is the local one. And 500 members, whatever it is, or ward. Is it ward?
I think ward.
Yeah, I thought ward was the local one and stake was the larger. You don't think so? Okay. Well, anyway, whatever it is, he is the bishop. And he said, none of us get paid. There are no paid professionals in the Mormon church, except the 12 on top or something who have a salary. But he said, I was a missionary in Germany for 2 years. And he said, I saw the problem in the German church. Everybody left it up to the clergy. If you ask people, why don't you do the witnessing? Why don't you? Oh, that's what we pay. That's what the state pays the pastor for. We pay taxes. And he said, I think that the Lutheran church in America has the same mentality. And I don't know, maybe he's right. But I certainly see that the congregations that have come alive to their parish and to their ministry are those congregations where the lay people have a high degree of investment in the life of that congregation and the witness of that congregation. So I see that as being very important. I see that we have to stop giving the ministry all the gifts of the Spirit and say the gifts of the Spirit exist in the whole congregation, so that a guy like Rich Kemmerer, who is not ordained, but a fantastic preacher, could be an evangelist anywhere, would be identified as the preacher in that congregation and let the pastor do the pastoring. You know, since when have the gifts of preaching and pastoring been combined? They're separate in the scriptures. And yet we've suddenly, ordination brings all the gifts of the Spirit. Instead of saying the gifts of the Spirit exist in the community and all people. So we have to reclaim and identify and reclaim the gifts out of the community. That's one reason, even though I have, you know, my theological training, my undergraduate work in Greek and Bible, and my graduate work in theology, I have been twice offered ordination. I have felt committed that my destiny lies with the laity of the church. And I think we have to get back to a theologically trained and equipped laity so that we're all in ministry. And the fourth one is that I think we need new training for the ordained and lay ministry. I don't think our traditional Lutheran training is doing us any good in non-traditional Lutheran areas. And when I talk to pastors, they say, nothing that I had in my seminary training has equipped me to work in a pluralistic society. And I throw that out as a challenge. Okay, I want to leave some material with you. You can take one of these if you're interested. It's a publication that I publish just to encourage congregations in an area that's changing rapidly. I want to show you some of the non-traditional things we're doing to make a non-Lutheran population aware of what the Lutheran Church is. One of our pastors, who's in a very pluralistic area, very Asian, very Hispanic, very black, and some whites, looked around to see what people were reading. And he saw that everybody in the grocery store was picking up a copy of what?
National Enquirer.
So he decided he was going to flood the community with a paper people would read, not the church bulletin, you know, which nobody reads, throws in the wastebasket with other junk mail. So this was his first issue. He found out that if the people got together and laid it out, they could take it to the Glendale Rotary Press, and for $250, they could get 10,000 copies of this paper. And for $210, they could use their mass mailing privilege and send it out to 10,000 people with a reverse phone book, which he could get from a realtor in the congregation. So they did. This was his first issue. Would you read that if it came to your door?
Yeah.
Infant Jesus was a girl. What do you think the story is about? Their Christmas pageant and the baby in it was a girl. But of course you'd read it, you'd say, what's that? That's terrible. And you read it and it's about the Christmas pageant. There's a story in the back, widow with eight children. Well, you know, what's the widow with eight children? And that church, from being almost dead after the great earthquake of 1971, and it's in Sylmar where it was the epicenter of the earthquake, and people left their homes and they were sold to low-income people, from being almost dead, is now plugged on Sunday. As a result of that first issue, they got six families who came to see who was there and what was happening. And yet every issue has a teaching on baptism, or something else. So I brought some of the copies of their latest paper with me to, you can take if you want to see how it's done. And one of the little paragraphs here is where have all the Norwegians gone? What he's saying is, we started out as a Norwegian Lutheran church, but now our membership includes Samoans, Filipinos, whatever. And then I'll leave a copy. In our, where Erling is the pastor in Garden Grove, we're right in the shadow of Schuller. And we appreciate Schuller, but Schuller has warned all the pastors in Garden Grove. He said, when I get my crystal cathedral built, I am going to scour this community for all the people that I can gather in, because I got to fill up that crystal cathedral. He's honest, see? Mm. And so before Easter, to beat Schuller to the punch, we put out our own paper, and it says, A Loving Place to Celebrate Easter. And that's St. Olaf Lutheran Church. What can you do with a name like St. Olaf in an area where the population is 1 to 2% Lutheran? You got to do something to let them know what it is. And so the other side has, God has something special for you at St. Olaf. And then we tell them about our program. And inside, because we live in an area where infant baptism is really downgraded, our whole inside is a teaching on how Priscilla Denise became a child of God. And then down here, Lutherans baptize infants as well as adults. And there's a teaching on the grace of God and why we baptize infants. And Lutherans promote lifelong learning about education as valuable and teaching. And as a result of that, Erling has baptized some babies out of the neighborhood, people who didn't think it was important anymore. And we've gotten some families to come, and we have sent to 10,000 people in the area. Because I think that this has got to be a new technique. How many people do you need to get into 10,000 homes? How many homes would you get into? But these are delivered for you to 10,000 homes in the area, and they reach those people in a way you can never reach them. So we're trying some new things. We have to do some new evangelism things out in our area. Those of you who live in predominantly Lutheran communities, you don't have to worry about that, I don't think. But unless you get it. But you can have copies of these if you're interested, just to see what's happening too. So I'll leave them here if you want to get them. Thank you very much. Wish we had more time.